This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Issue which doesn't really seem to fit. We discussed last week how the whole first part of Devarim involves words of Musar, and how later on in the parasha there start to be repetitions and expansions on earlier mitzvahs. In the middle of this week said that before the Ten Commandments, which is a repetition of something earlier, it says, "Oz then Yavdil Moshe Sholosh Orim Be'ever Hayarden Mizrach Hashemesh." Moshe set aside three cities on the other side of the Jordan, Lanus Shama Ritzach Asher Yitzach Israel Bevlidas, for a murderer to flee there if he murders accidentally, V'hu Lo Sonelo Mitmol Shilshon, having murdered somebody with whom he doesn't have a history of antagonism, V'Nos El Achas Min Heorim Ha'il, and he shall flee to one of these cities, V'Chai, and he shall live. So there's a mitzvah that we have been given already, which is the instruction given to Moshe Rabbeinu that there have to be six cities separated, three on Eber HaYarden, three on the other side of the Jordan, and three in Eretz Israel itself. The purpose of these cities were twofold. Firstly, they were going to be cities that were occupied by the Levim. The Levim didn't have property, they didn't have land, meaning agricultural land, and they were going to live in these cities. In addition to that, it would be a place to which people who murdered accidentally could flee in order to escape the wrath of the family of the murdered person. It's just one of the facts of life that if a dear one has been killed, however accidental it is, the family somehow never forgives the person who killed, and therefore the person who killed finds his life at risk and finds his health at risk, even though he did nothing wrong, nothing deliberately wrong. So we send him off for his own protection. We send him off to an Ir Miklat, to a shelter city, where he's looked after. Where in other words, we say really it's a strange situation. He didn't murder on purpose, so really he's not guilty. On the other hand, it's natural for the family of the murdered people to feel antagonistic and to want to murder him. And in fact, if they do, we don't really hold them responsible. There's nothing you can do about that, because they're also not responsible. It's also not a rational, deliberate murder. That's the way people behave. And so the only way we can avoid the conflict is to separate them. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes conflict can be resolved by bringing people together and sitting down and trying to sort it out. And sometimes the best that one can do, at least for a period of time, is to separate people in a position of conflict. When two dogs are fighting, you don't sit them down at a conference table and say, "Come now, let's talk it out." You just keep them apart, that's all, and that's the way you have peace. So it is with the Ir Miklat, the only way that you can separate these people, the only way that you can have peace between these two parties is to separate them. That was the function of the Ir Miklat. Now the din is that they don't acquire the status of an Ir Miklat until all six are appointed. When the three in Eretz Israel, as well as the three on Eber Yarden, are all specified and set aside for the purposes of being an Ir Miklat, then they all become an Ir Miklat. Until that stage, they don't. And that's the first difficulty that the Mephoshim have with this parasha. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu fix the three cities if the other three could not yet be fixed? What's the point? The whole mitzvah cannot be completed. These cities don't start functioning until they get into Eretz Yisrael, and there the other three will be appointed, and then all six become an Ir Miklat. But until that time, they don't function. Secondly, why is it exactly here? What's in the middle of everything? All of a sudden, Moshe is in the middle of a drosha. The whole of Sefer Dvorim is a speech. It's a piece of oratory by Moshe Rabbeinu. From the beginning until nearly the very end of the Sefer Dvarim, this is Moshe's parting speech before his death. It's not the normal custom that in the middle of a speech one gets up and does all sorts of funny things. And here Moshe in the middle, "Oz Yavdil Moshe," then Moshe stopped his speech and he declared three cities to be Arei Miklas. Three cities were Betzer, Romus, and Goylon. And thirdly, the use of the word Az. The Torah in fact tells us then he did it, as if it's important to know that that's when he did it. In other words, we're told it here not just because it happens to have happened then, but it's important to know that it was then at that point that Moshe Rabbeinu committed this act of being mavdil the cities, of setting aside these three cities as orei miklat. The Medrash gives us an answer. Az yavdil Moshe. Zeshem Rakosuf, says the Medrash, this is what is written in Kohelet. Ohev kesef lo yispa kesef. A person who loves money will never have enough money. That's why Moshe did it. I can understand that, but that's what it says. Fortunately, the Medrash explains it. The Medrash deals firstly with this posuk in Kohelet. Ohev kesef lo yispa kesef. A person who loves money will never have enough money. Ein anu yodim she'ein odom memale es nafsho? Don't we already know this principle? Do we need a posuk to tell us that an ambitious person never fulfills his ambition, he never makes it, because of in matters of money? Rabbonin Amri said, can't mean the simple meaning. We don't need Shlomo HaMelech to come and tell us that a person who loves money never has enough. All you have to do is you have to look around you, and you'll see people who've got money but they still work. That's because of Oyev Kesef, Luis by Kesef, and they work very hard. You'll find millionaires, billionaires, and they're up early in the morning sitting in their offices and they're worried about everything and they follow everything and they work terribly hard. They come home late at night, their family suffers, everything else suffers, they're working, working, working. Like Aniyim Poshet, they're working like people who don't have what to eat tomorrow. What's all the work for? Oyev Kesef, Luis by Kesef, there's never enough. Rabbonin Amri, so what is Shlomo HaMelech really coming to tell us? The Rabbonin said, Eilu Talmidei Chachomim. It's not talking about ordinary people, it's speaking about Talmidei Chachomim. She'oy havin divrei Torah shenim shulu b'kesef. And they love divrei Torah, which is compared to money. Omer Rav Nachman, Mi she'oy hev Torah, Einu soveya Torah. A person who loves Torah never has enough Torah. Another interpretation, Oyev Kesef, Omar Rav Yitzchek, Misha who Oyev Mitzvahs, Eino Soveya Min HaMitzvahs. The Kesef might be talking about Mitzvahs, not about Torah. And there too, anybody who loves Mitzvahs never has enough Mitzvahs. Ketzad, how for example, At Moitze Shnei Gedoyle Oilam. You find that there were two exceptionally great people, David and Moshe. King David and Moshe. The Loisavu, and they never had enough. David, even though Hashem said to David, regretfully, David, you are not going to build me this Beis HaMikdash. As much as you want to be the one who's going to build the Beis HaMikdash, I'm sorry, you can't. So what do you think David would have done? One would think David would have, he might have argued a bit, pressed a little bit, and then backed off. No. David said to himself, do you think just because God said to me I'm not going to build, I'm going to sit and do nothing? Also, what did he do? He applied zrizus, assiduousness to himself. And he started getting everything ready for the building. My Mishnah said I mustn't build, but I can start getting ready. Until he died. Carried on. He started immediately making preparations for the building, although he knew he would not do it. Likewise with Moshe, even though Hashem said to Moshe, for you will not cross this Jordan, Moshe said, just because I'm not going to go into Eretz Yisrael, am I going to keep one mitzvah undone, the separation of the Arei Miklat? Immediately then, at that point, as Yavdil Moshe, Moshe Rabbeinu started separating the cities. That's the Medrash. What we have here, and what I want to deal with here, is a tremendous definition and understanding of love. What ahava is, what it is to love. And in Torah we have different kinds of ahava. We have an ahavas Hashem, we have such a thing as loving the Ribbono Shel Olam. We have an ahavas Reim, such a thing as the love of one another. We have an ahava ben ish l'ishto, we have a love between man and wife. All sorts of things. We have an ahava satorah, we have a love of Torah. And love is a word which we've ceased to understand because we use it so often and we use it for such a broad range of meanings and objects, but we don't fully understand what it means. And in this Midrash we already have the roots of some of the principles. Superficially, we'll have to do it more deeply in a few moments, but superficially, Oyev kesef lo yuspa kesef. A person who loves money will not have enough money. What does that mean? The one thing that it means is the theorem itself. If you love money, you won't have enough. Pshuto kemashmo, that's what it means. But there is the converse of the theorem as well. If you have enough money, you don't love money. And that's the important part. It's the converse, which in fact is the limud. This is the indication, this is the siman, this is the symptom of love. Anything that you are capable of having enough of, you don't love. That's the one. The second one is from Moshe Rabbeinu and David HaMelech, which we'll have to understand with a little bit more depth. But basically they were told that even though they knew they would not perform the action, that didn't stop them doing it. We need to understand a few things about ahava, about love. The first thing is that there are basically three types of motivations within a human being for doing something. A human being will do something either, well, it's first divided into two general categories. Either through kathiyah, he's forced. There's something outside of him which is forcing him. Or through rotzon, he wants to do it. Kfiyah means a person comes along and he says, if you don't do it, I'll shoot you, I'll whip you, I'll fire you, somebody else will take your job, you won't be promoted. That's kfiyah. It's a person being forced to do something. Rotzon, a person does something because he has an inner need to do it. Some of the people who write poetry or compose music, nobody's forcing them to do it. They don't even have to do it for a panos to earn a living. They have the means of earning a living, so why do they sit all night and write music? They have an inner need to do it. Then you have a third type, which we need to subcategorize, and that is the person who does it because he appreciates the importance of the results. So for example, a person doesn't have an inner need to work, nor is anybody forcing him. But he appreciates the importance of having a bit of money, let's say. And therefore he works. He could manage without it as well. He's not forced to work. Nor is there an inner rotzon. But he appreciates the need to work because he appreciates the value of having reward. Let's call that the motivation of expedience. One form of expedience or another. I'm doing it because the result is worthwhile to me. I'm doing it because I want the consequences. I want the result. Let's look at these three and understand them. If a person does something because of kfiyah, he's obliged to do it, that would appear to be the lowest level of operation. That's a kind of slavery. It's not something that I willingly do. It's not something that I want to do. It's something that I have to do. If I do something because of expedience, it's also quite a low level of operation. It's politics. I'm doing it because I'm going to get something for it afterwards. What would you say about the person who does something because he has the inner need to do it? Would you say, but think carefully, is that the highest level or is that the lowest level? I have a need, that's why I do it. What would you say? The lowest level. It's the most selfish of all. If I do it because somebody's forcing me, it depends who's forcing me. The Ribbono Shel's forcing me, let's say. God told me to do it, and that's why I do, because I'm scared of the Ribbono Shel. That's one level, but at least I'm doing it for God. Or I'm doing it because I understand that if I do it, I'll get Olam Haba. The consequences are worthwhile. It's hard and all the rest of it, but after 120 years, I'll have Olam Haba. At least I'm doing it for Olam Haba, something that is over there. But if I do it because I need to do it, I have an inner need. I get aggravated if I don't do it. If I don't keep Shabbos, my whole week is messed up, so that's why I keep Shabbos. Surely that's not on the same kind of level, and that's what one would feel. A person can love another person for the same three reasons. You can love them compulsively, which is kfiyah. Compulsiveness in a person is exactly what it is. It's a form of an external imposition. an external authority on an individual. So there are all sorts of compulsive loves, what it is that's driving him to it, but it's something external, something outside of him. So there is this compulsive form of loving. Then there's the form of loving of expedience. It's nice to love. If I love my wife, I get supper. It's nice, it's good, it pays. Not such a form of love. And then there's the third form of love. It feels good, I need it. If I don't love my wife, or if I don't have my wife, there's something lacking in me, and that's not good. Here again, that would seem to be totally self-centered, totally selfish. Maybe there are other forms of love, we'll have a look at that in a moment, but one thing seems clear, and that is that the motivation, whether it's a motivation in love or a motivation in action, to do it because I have a lack in me if I don't do it, on the surface that appears to be the lowest. I learned Torah. Why are you learning Torah, Rabbi? Because I love it. If I don't learn Torah, my mind lies fallow, and I'm not operating on a peak level. I'm not the same if I don't learn Torah. That's why I'm learning Torah. That's not a reason to learn Torah, we would say. And yet that's not really so. We see that in this medrash that we've just learnt, and this is the yesod of this medrash, love is compared to the relationship an individual has with food when he's hungry. That's really what it is. Lo yispa kesef. What is the word saveya? Or chalnu v'savanu. Saveya is this feeling of satisfaction that one feels when one's had a good meal. What is an oyev kesef? Lo yispa kesef. A person who is always hungry for money. Then he's an oyev kesef. If you love money, you'll always be hungry for it. And if you're not hungry for money, it means that you don't love it. Likewise with Torah. A person who's hungry for Torah or is hungry for mitzvahs, always, he's a person who loves. If he doesn't have that, he doesn't love. So we see that hunger is the closest one can come to understanding the need and the drive in an individual towards love, even to something as great as the love of Torah and mitzvahs. We're not even talking about the love of one individual to another. The second section of the Medrash. Moshe Rabbeinu carried on doing the mitzvahs of setting aside the three cities, even though he knew he would not complete them. What is the Medrash telling us here? What's so critical? Moshe Rabbeinu is about to give them the Ten Commandments a second time, to repeat the Ten Commandments, and then to go on to all sorts of other mitzvahs, which is going to stress to them, particularly the mitzvahs that have meaning in Eretz Yisrael, which he feels they need to be reminded about, and they need to pay special attention to. He introduces that with performing a mitzvah himself. They should learn by example, that's the first. Even before he starts teaching them, part of his drosha, and this is the beauty of the Medrash. It's not that he's mafsik his drosha, it's not that he stopped his speech to go and be mavdil the cities, to separate the cities and make them arei miklat. No, this is part of the drosha. Sometimes the drosha needs to be acted out, there needs to be action in it as well, there needs to be a little bit of drama. Part of the drosha is as an introduction to the mitzvahs, before I start telling you what the mitzvahs are, see how one performs the mitzvahs, Eden. I'm now going to do a mitzvah, watch. Which mitzvah? I'm going to perform the mitzvah of separating the Orem Miklat. People must have stood there, scratching their heads, wondering as Moshe got old, what's so? He's got to choose that mitzvah, the one mitzvah which he can't do. Why doesn't he choose a mitzvah which he can do? Why doesn't he say, look, watch me put on tefillin. Watch me bench Birkas HaMozon. Watch me say Amid Tzilechim in Orex. Watch me give Tzedokah. No. Watch me separate the cities. A mitzvah which he in fact is unable to do. It's not counted as a mitzvah until the six are done. It doesn't take effect until all six are done. And he knows he's not going to do the other six. That's how he started off the Sedra. How he appealed to God that he should let him cross the Yarden. And the Ribbono Shel Olam said no. So he knows he's never going to get there. What is he going to choose? This mitzvah, punk the one that he can't fulfill, that's the one he shows us as his example. It says the Medrash, because that's exactly what he wants to teach them. Even mitzvahs which you can't complete and which you know you can't complete, you do as well, as far as you can go. Why? It's impossible to understand why on the surface. Until we go back to our principle in the Medrash of the comparison of Ahava with the relationship of a man to his food when he's hungry. Why do we eat? Really, we eat so that we should be healthy. That's the real reason that we eat. We eat because we need proteins, and we need vitamins, and we need carbohydrates, and all the other things that make us tick. That's why we eat. But what really motivates us to eat? hunger is what really motivates us. What will happen if a man is hungry and I say to him, I bring him food that is not nutritious for him, very hungry, and I bring him his food which is, let's say, only carbohydrates. He's quite fat already. He doesn't need carbohydrates. That's not what he needs. He needs protein. But I bring him a delicious cake with a cup of strong coffee with a lot of sugar in it, and I put it before him. Is he going to eat or not? Oh, of course he's going to eat. He's going to enjoy it. He's going to tuck into it. But what are you doing? It's not for you. It's not doing you any good. But I'm hungry. I love it. That's what hungry means. It means I love it. And I want it. To be hungry for a mitzvah means to do the mitzvah even when it's not just for the end. It's not just that the end justifies the means. But to do the mitzvah because the actual doing of the mitzvah is pleasant too. When a person is hungry and he's eating, what pleasure is he getting? Is the pleasure sort of the intellectual knowledge that Baruch Hashem, now I'm going to have all the proteins and vitamins that I need. Oh, a tainug, that's beautiful. Isn't that lovely? That's not what it is. And then he says, kavona in his benching, thanks to the Ribbono Shel Olam for giving him these proteins and things, and if we would give him a little bottle of tablets and things, it wouldn't satisfy him. The nachas, the geschmack of a good meal is that my hunger is eased. That's what's nice. The act of eating is pleasurable, not the result of eating. Yet what am I eating for? For the action or for the result? I'm eating for the result, but what I enjoy is the action. That's how it is when you love something. When you love something, it's true that you might do it for the end result. But what you enjoy is the doing of it. You don't just enjoy, you don't just do it for the end result. If a person does exercises, does gymnastics, maybe with the exception of you, Russell, or a couple of other people, they don't enjoy it mainly. They do it because at the end they know that they will feel good when they're finished. That's all they know. How's it with you? With you, you probably enjoy it as well. You hate it as well? Oh, Baruch Hashem, that's good. That's it. So why do you do it? You know at the end it's going to be good. You're going to feel good. You know that if you don't do it, you'll feel bad. So you do it. But to go and say you love the action, up and down, up and down, up and down, tired, sweating, there would be something wrong with a person who loved the action. And it's a pleasure in the action. It would be sadistic. There would be something mentally wrong with such a person. Says the Medrash, on this very pasuk of Oyev Kesef, Lo Yispa Kesef, a person who loves money never has enough, a person who loves Torah never has enough Torah, a person who loves mitzvahs never has enough mitzvahs. What does it mean never has enough mitzvahs? Even if I don't need them anymore, I still want them. That's what it means. Even if they're not doing me any good because I can't complete them or for whatever reason, I can't build the Beis HaMikdash, I can't set aside the six cities, it's not for me to do, it's not my mitzvah. But as much as I can do, at least that I've got to do. That doesn't mean, of course, that one should go around doing mitzvahs that one isn't chayav to do altogether. For example, and the kabbonis now when there's no Beis HaMikdash or things like that, because, you know, even though we can't do the mitzvahs, still we must do them. What it means is that mitzvahs which theoretically apply to me, just I don't have to do them and I can't really do them, as much as I can do towards the ultimate fulfillment of that mitzvah, that yes, that I must do. So what emerges is that the most noble, if we're going to regard love as noble, let's start there. If we're going to regard love as noble, that noble emotion has as its source a hunger, an inner need. And our initial attitude was wrong. We started looking at a person who is motivated by his own needs as somebody selfish. We now come out now that the motivation by your own emptiness and your own need is in fact what love is all about. And again, even something as high as love of Torah and love of mitzvahs. And that needs a little bit of understanding. How it can be that something so selfish, because we're almost saying that one of the greatest levels is the feeling of hunger, the feeling of eating when you're hungry. Well, in a sense, yes, it's a kind of an ahava. It just happens that the object of one's love is not something very noble, it's just ordinary food. But that kind of application and that kind of emotion is something very noble, although it's merely the satisfaction of one's needs. You know, in psychology and in psychiatry, it became very fashionable at the time of Freud and thereafter to start terming everything as A is nothing but, and B is nothing but, and everything is nothing but, and at the end of it, what they used to come down to is it's nothing but the satisfaction of some need or other in an individual. And the interpretation of everybody's behavior is on that level. Ah, that's nothing but an individual's need for power. That's nothing but an individual's need for this. That's nothing but an individual's need for that. and they classified people like that in general terms, and also they started looking at individuals like that, and they reduced everybody's heroic actions as to nothing but, he was such a hero, Churchill was a big hero. That was nothing but his need for publicity. That's all it was. Down comes Churchill. Some soldiers, Moser Nefesh, to save another person's life. That was nothing but his need for recognition. Everything. A husband who loves his wife, that is nothing but a need to fulfill his insecurity. And so they go, and everything is nothing but a need. Even if they're right, that it's nothing but a need, the nothing but is wrong. Who says that the fulfilling of a need is such a terrible thing? If the Ribbono Shel Olam created us with those needs, perhaps the greatest thing we can do, and perhaps our first responsibilities, are to fulfill those needs, not to neglect them. How is it that there can be an ahavo, something so great, motivated by something seemingly so low, one's own personal needs? I think there's a beautiful concept that lies beneath this. A love of another person, because without that person, one is inadequate. I don't feel complete without that person. And that's the basis of my love. There's a tremendous aspect of humility in that love. One is actually saying, it's not that I love that person just to fulfill my need. That's the one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is, I am nothing without that person. And with that person, look what I am. It's in fact a feeling to a degree of hisbatlus, a degree of personal diminishing one's own importance in one's own eyes. It comes out exactly the opposite to the way one originally looked at it. When the psychiatrists say this is nothing but the fulfillment of his own need for A, B or C, it's an arrogant sort of statement. This is nothing but his own self-centered needs. But if one looks at it with a bit of thought and with a bit of understanding, what I'm saying is, I have needs. And there's a lot of humility in saying that I have needs. Sometimes we like to pretend that we have no needs. I don't need society, I'm independent. I don't need money, I have tremendous bitachon. I don't need friends, I operate. I couldn't care less about what people say or think of me, it makes no difference. I don't need teachers, I know everything. I don't need talmidim, they're not up to my standard, I can't waste my time teaching them. Each person, I don't need chavrusas. In each person's area of operation, it becomes very easy, and in fact it becomes almost a heroic sort of stance to adopt the attitude of, I don't need, I have no needs. And the fewer needs we have, the greater we are. That's the way things are portrayed. Ayn Rand developed a whole philosophy which caught on like wildfire around the heroism of not needing other people, not caring about what other people say, being independent. Isn't like that. That's not a human being. A human being is created incomplete. He is created with needs. And that's part of his greatness. How useless he is on his own. How nothing he is on his own. And how great he can be if those needs are fulfilled. That's what's the greatness of a human being. A man who doesn't have a teacher. What's he? Nothing. A man who has a teacher, look how great he can become. A teacher who doesn't have a pupil, what is he? He's nothing, he's not a teacher. And with a pupil, look how great he can become. A husband who doesn't have a wife, what is he? What can he do? What can he achieve? A wife who doesn't have a husband, what can she achieve? Nothing, very limited and very restricted. And together, just look what they can achieve. And so it goes with everything. Without society, a man becomes a hermit and locks himself away from society. He doesn't communicate, he doesn't operate in a society. What can he achieve ultimately? Nothing in real terms. And through society and with society, if he handles it right, look what he can only achieve. And we've spoken often about the tremendous fear that I have anyway, particularly with our present generation, of the infiltration of Western ideology into Torah minds, into our minds. There was a time when Torah people were totally protected and isolated from alien philosophy. People used to live in a ghetto, and they used to go from an early age to a frum school, and they used to learn Torah, and that's all they used to learn, that's all they used to see, that's all they used to hear. And if they were exposed at any stage to Western civilization, it was when they were already old and mature, when they could already handle it with a Torah background. knowing a Torah philosophy and having a Torah background and having a Torah attitude, now if they were confronted with something from the secular world, they could handle it and they could confront it with the confidence of their Torah knowledge. But with us, it's the opposite. We're introduced to philosophy with Western philosophy. We're introduced to literature with Western literature. Our values, our way of looking at the world, everything comes from the street. And then we try and learn Torah. And the tendency is to try and fit the Torah into this mold that we already have in our minds. We don't cast that out and replace it with a new mold called Torah. No. Everything we hear in Torah, we're trying to fit into this funny, distorted picture which we already have inside ourselves. And as I've mentioned so many times, what is disturbing in the process of becoming frum, and we're all busy becoming frum, everybody is how little emphasis is placed on the realigning of one's attitudes. That one has to start looking at the world differently, that one has to start understanding the world differently, that one has to start analyzing the world differently. It becomes merely a matter of transforming one's actions and one's lifestyle, but not transforming one's way of looking at things. It's a very alien idea that man's inadequacy is something low down. That man's inadequacy, that his needs, the fact that he has needs, is nothing but, is something small, is something to be glossed over, and is something pathetic. It isn't pathetic, it's great. It's his needs which give him the ability to love. A man who has no needs has no love. A woman who has no needs has no love. It cannot be. One cannot love if one has no need. If that is the case, what about one's love for the Ribbono Shel Olam? What is one's need for the Ribbono Shel Olam? What are we without the Ribbono Shel Olam? It comes out that without the Ribbono Shel Olam, we are literally nothing. If God withdrew himself from us for one moment, we would literally just disintegrate. We would just collapse into a collection of molecules and atoms and all sorts of things and probably just disappear into the atmosphere somewhere. That's what would happen if he withdrew himself from us for a moment. We are nothing. I'm not even talking on more sophisticated levels of if the Ribbono Shel Olam wouldn't help us, we wouldn't manage, and if he wasn't guiding us, we wouldn't be able to cope, and if he wasn't protecting us. I'm not even talking on that level. Just if he removed himself from us scientifically, we would be nothing. We would cease to exist immediately. There would be no existence. Ein oid milvadoi. There is nothing but the Ribbono Shel Olam. Take the God away, there is nothing. The world minus God equals naught. What about one's love then for the Ribbono Shel Olam? If love is an expression of a need, if love is an understanding that without my beloved I am inadequate and with him I am complete, how great is the love for the Ribbono Shel Olam? Provided one understands one's inadequacy without him, and one understands the adequacy and the greatness that one can achieve with him. And perhaps that's the anomaly that David HaMelech himself talks about. Ma enosh kitiv kirena venadam kitiv kirena. What is a human being that you even mention him, Ribbono Shel Olam? Look at a human being. What is he? He has no metzias on the earth. He's nothing without you. But techasreyu me'at me'elukim, and yet he's just a little less than the Ribbono Shel Olam. He's a little bit less than God. He has aspects of godliness to him. What does it mean if he's nothing? He's nothing. If he's godly, he's godly. It means without God, he's nothing. And with God, he's nearly God. With God, he's almost limitless in what he can achieve, in what he can perceive, in what he can understand, in what he can live, in what he can act. Almost limitless. Provided it's with the Ribbono Shel Olam. What love. What ahava. One finds in our kind of society that when a human being discovers that he's dependent on somebody else, very often a resentment builds up. And he discovers that he can't manage without somebody else, almost a sort of a hatred develops. That is the relationship between somebody who is inadequate but refuses to believe that he's inadequate, and the person on whom he leans. It's a necessary requirement of love, as selfish as that love is, because it's a fulfillment of my needs. But the first step in that love is the acknowledgement that I have needs. It's the acknowledgement and the acceptance. But I am inadequate, so what? That's how God made me. But he gave me the ability to fulfill that inadequacy. He gave me the ability to round it off. He gave me the ability to find people and things to complement myself so that I can become perfect, but not on my own. I need others. No individual can become perfect on his own. Once that is the case, we can test our love very easily, and the results are sometimes quite shocking. My father always says, people say, I love my wife and I love chocolate pudding, therefore my wife is a chocolate pudding. What does it mean, I love chocolate pudding and I love my wife? Is that the same word that we're using? Is it the same feeling? Is it the same emotion? We see from the Medrash that it is. Chocolate pudding is the kind of thing that you eat, although you know it does you no good, so why do you eat it and why do you enjoy it so much? Because you love it. That's the answer. The first thing that one has to test is one's hunger satiable? If one's hunger is satiable, it's not a real ahava. So the hunger for food is not a real love. And it's correct that we don't use the word love for it. What word do we use in Hebrew? Taiva and chemda, right? Taiva and chemda. These are different words, and in the Aseret HaDibros and the Ten Commandments, we have both words used. One in Lo Tachmod and one in, today we read Lo Titaveh. You shall not desire. There's such a thing as desire, but desire is not love. No matter how much you desire, when a man is about to die of hunger, and he sees a chocolate cake at the end of the room, or a steak, or a beautiful roast beef, that feeling is not love, it's taiva, it's something else. What's the test? Because when he's eaten it, he won't want it anymore. That's a sign that it's not love. And on that basis, it becomes so simple when one understands the yisodas, when one understands the gedorim, the definitions, the principles. Things become so simple to see and to understand. What happens about marriages that start cracking up at honeymoon? What is it? It's basically a marriage based on a taiva, not an ahava. It's marriage based on a hunger, not on a love. They were very hungry before they got together. Now that they've been together for a week all on their own, the hunger's gone, just like when you finish the chocolate cake. You don't want it anymore. It's finished. And then starts the decline. And maybe if you separate them a while, they get up and down, but it becomes like food. You eat every day. You eat three times a day even, and when you eat, you're hungry. But when you're finished eating, you're finished with it. You don't want it anymore. And many, many marriages, probably most marriages today, oh, like that. They have their times of hunger when there's a degree of closeness and they get on well. And as soon as that's over and as soon as they're just getting on nicely, and all of a sudden they lose interest again. What's happened? The meal's over. Finished. They've been together a while. That's the sign that there's something wrong in the basis of the relationship. The relationship is not one of ahava. The relationship is not one of love. The relationship is one of taiva and chemda. It's one of desire and want, not one of love. And the second requirement, that the action is fulfilling in itself, not only as a means to an end. This is a very frightening test. You should try it out. You can try it out as I'm talking to you. Think it out, but think honestly. You've had a hard day's work. That makes no difference if you're a man or a lady. You've had a hard day's work. If you're a lady, apart from your work, the children have been crying and up, and you've just got them to bed and finished with them, and you've had a bath, ready to go to bed. And if you're a man, you've had a hassling day at work and you've come home and you went to a shir and you came back. And it's been a rough day. As you're about to get into bed, your spouse says, please darling, can you bring me a cup of tea? Now, I'm not talking about the person who doesn't, says no. I hope there's no such person sitting here. I'm talking about the person who does it. I'm not even talking about the person who does it with a long face and with a grudge. I hope there's no such person sitting over here. I'm talking about the person who does it with a smile and with pleasure. All I want to know is, what is the pleasure from? Is the pleasure from bringing the cup of tea back and seeing her enjoy it? Or do you actually sing as you make, you're turning on the kettle and you're in ecstasy? The thing itself. And what would happen if you knew for sure that by the time you brought the cup of tea back, she would be asleep? And believe it or not, in a marriage that kind of thing happens. You knew for sure, absolute sure. There's no question about it. No matter how quickly the kettle boils and how little water you put in, you know for sure you're going to come back and she's going to be asleep. So what do you do then? Do you still make it? Because I love making coffee for my wife. That's why I'm there. I don't care whether she drinks it or not. I love making coffee for my wife. That's what the Medrash says, isn't it? Moshe knew he couldn't finish the job. David HaMelech knew he could never build the Beis HaMikdash. That's not going to stop me from occupying myself with the job because I love mitzvahs. And loving mitzvahs means loving the action, not only the consequence. To do it for the consequence, that's a degree of compulsiveness. It's important. The end is also important. After all, it's the Ratzon Hashem. The Ribbono Shel Olam wants this thing to be completed and done. And that's the thing to which one has to work. But there also has to be enjoyment in doing it as an end in itself. That's it. We know what that means with ourselves. It's more difficult when we apply it to other people. But very often we will sit down to a job that we know we're not going to finish, let's say, even a book. You pick up a book at a friend's house, and you know you're not going to have time to finish it. But you've got time, or whatever, it's an exciting book, and you read it, you enjoy reading it. But you're not going to finish the book? Good, but you still had an entertaining hour. We understand the concept to do things for ourselves that we enjoy, even though we're not going to finish them. Even though there will be no end. Even though there will be no finality to it. But the doing of it is nice, so we do it. Very often we do it for ourselves. But do we ever do something for other people just because we love doing it, even though we know they're not going to get benefit from it at the end? Because the action is pleasurable. We don't. And that throws into question whether we know what it is to love. That's what it means. And Oyev Kesef, Lo Yisba Kesef means he is hungry for money, and therefore the action of earning money is a pleasure for him, apart from the achieving of the money at the end. The businessman who loves business, he loves making the deal, even if he knows that it might not come to finality. Even if he knows that it will not come to finality. Even if he knows that it's going to take 50 years and his children are going to have to finish it off, he's not going to finish it off. And even if he knows that he doesn't need it and his children don't need it, they've got plenty to live on. But he loves it, he enjoys it, so he does it. We do it for ourselves. Do we do it for others? Oyev Kesef Lo Yisba Kesef, a man who's not hungry for money. That means he enjoys making it like you enjoy eating when you're hungry, even if it doesn't do you any good. Such a man is not an Oyev Kesef, he's not a lover of money. And Oyev Teiro Lo Yisba Teiro, if you can say at the end of the day, enough learning for today. If you can say that phrase to yourself, you're not Noyev Torah. You don't know what it is to love Torah. Sometimes one has to say, it's not enough, I want to carry on, but what can I do? If I don't sleep, tomorrow's going to be a wreck, so I've got to go and sleep. That's a different attitude. I love learning, I want to carry on learning, but I've got to go to work also, otherwise it's no good. But the attitude of Abtan, that's finished, and close one safer and go off, that's not an Oyev Torah. The same as you couldn't stop off in the middle of eating if you're still hungry. You're not hungry if you can do that. A man is really ravenous. And you give him a few crumbs, this is good. Enough, here, let's go now. So if you weren't hungry, obviously. That's a sign that you weren't hungry, it can't be. So also, if we get to the end of an action, if we're able to say, Genug, I'm saveh, I've had enough for today. That's a sign that we're not yet holding by Ohev Torah. And likewise by mitzvahs. If one says, look, this mitzvah doesn't, I'm not going to really be able to finish it, and I'm not really chayev, I don't have to do this mitzvah really, and I've done enough mitzvahs today. That's not an Ohev mitzvah. And if in interpersonal relationships the same thing, if one finds that one can have enough of a person, really getting on one's nerves, that's not an Ohev. What is the difference between a person who loves his wife and a person who loves chocolate pudding? The difference is in the satiability. And the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos that kol ahavo shitluya b'dova, any love which is dependent on something, b'teilo adova, b'teilo ahavo, once that thing is gone, the love is gone. So if a person loves his wife because she's wealthy, if she loses her money, he loses his love. If a person loves his wife because she's beautiful, if she loses her beauty, he loses his love. And kol avo she'eno b'teilo, eino tluya b'dova, any love which is not dependent on anything. Eino b'teilo, that love will never become bottled, it will never become nullified. What is the difference? It's true that an avo, a love, is the fulfillment of a need. But there's a big difference between the fulfillment of a physical need and the fulfillment of a spiritual need. The fulfillment of a physical need is measurable. The fulfillment of a spiritual need is only qualitative, it's not measurable. If a human being is hungry, and he needs, so he wants something to eat. But you could ask him, what do you need to eat? He could tell you exactly what he needs and what he wants to eat. And he can tell you at what point he will have had enough. So you'll say, I'm terribly hungry. So you'll say, right, I'm going to bring you 6 roast beefs and 3 chickens. You say, don't be ridiculous. And one slice of roast beef is enough with a piece of bread to go with it and then a cup of tea. That will be fine. And you can define exactly what he needs. And when you've given him what he needs, that's over. It's done with. A person has a spiritual need. He has a need to make music. He has a need to write poetry. He has a need to whatever it is. He has a need. He has a need to help people. He has a need to teach, he has a need to study, whatever it is. If you went up to Beethoven, you said, excuse me, Mr. Beethoven, how much music do you need to produce in order to satisfy your needs? The answer, endless. It's not possible. The need to produce music is not a need to produce a certain quantity of music. It's to produce a certain quality of music. And I won't be satisfied until I get to that. And he knows that by the time he's got to that, if he ever does, his standards have gone even higher and he still isn't satisfied. It's something which never reaches satiation, never reaches satisfaction, because it isn't quantifiable. And that's the difference between I love my wife and I love the chocolate pudding. In essence, it's the same feeling. I need it. I have a need. There's an emptiness in me that can be fulfilled by nothing but food. Therefore I love food. Therefore I'm hungry for food. I have a need within me which can be fulfilled by nobody but my wife. Or by nobody but my friend. That's the same kind of feeling in a sense. But the one is hopefully spiritual and the one is physical. If it's a physical need, it's quantifiable, and when you've given him what he needs, the love is over. If it's spiritual, you can never give him what he needs. You can never finish giving him what he needs. He needs it continuously, and the moment you take it away from him, his lack is there again. It doesn't finish. In a marriage situation, that's a very important principle. Because a lot of the kinkiness and weirdness of a lot of relationships is based on the fact that what I wanted, I've already got. So I need to want something else now. And eventually people run out of ideas of what to do. Whereas when the basis of that love is a spiritual basis, it's not just something physical that I need, it's something spiritual that I need. There is no end to the eating. There is no end to the satisfaction. There doesn't come a point where you say, I've had enough, thank you. It's not like that. It changes its form. It's different. Each day is different, but there's this continuous need. Take it away. One can be together 50 years. And if there's love, and the husband and wife are separated for a day, he has to go away on business or whatever, after 50 years of being together, the two of them are falling apart already. What's going wrong? 50 years? Not enough? No, it's not enough. It's not a stage of how much. At all times, I need a certain relationship. And when I don't have that, I'm missing it. I'm lacking it. That's when it's a spiritual relationship. And perhaps that's the neatest definition, in a very simplified form, and hopefully over the coming weeks we'll take it further, of compulsiveness. Compulsiveness is a need for something quantifiable. It's something very specific. It's something which, it's there, one knows what it is. And one needs and one goes after it. A spiritual need is something very subtle. It's something that's difficult to define exactly what it is, and it's never satisfied. No matter how much you get of it, the yispa, it never satisfies. On the contrary, it creates within itself, in fact, more of the need. If a person has a need to produce, the more he produces, the more he needs to produce. If a person has a need for love, the more he loves, the more he needs to love. So it goes. With spiritual things, you never get to the point where it is the end. And it doesn't matter, because it is the action itself which is so fulfilling. It's the act of eating itself, quite apart from the end, which is so fulfilling and which is so important. The more we feel ourselves inadequate, and the more we see to what extent the other party or the other object makes us adequate and fulfills our inadequacy, the greater is the love. The more extensive is the love. The hisbatlus, the humility that must be a precondition to love. An arrogant person cannot love. A person who feels that he has whatever he needs cannot love. It is only when he understands his own inadequacies and he sees within the other party the ability to satisfy that inadequacy that he can develop a love for that other person. The love for the Ribbono Shel Olam is the greatest of all love. Provided we understand ourselves and we understand God. If we see how useless we are on our own and how infinite is our potential together with the Ribbono Shel Olam, the love for the Ribbono Shel Olam becomes very great. And I'm thinking possibly over the next couple of weeks of doing a couple of shiurim developing these ideas, love between man and the Ribbono Shel Olam, based on these principles, how does one develop it? How does it come? What is it? How does one work on it? Moving from there to the love between man and man, the love between man and wife, and so on, and try and understand some of the concepts of Ahava based on these principles. The one question I'll leave you with, probably till next week, is if that is so, that the more inadequate we are, and the more we see the greatness of He whom we love, then it should be that the greatest love mates in the world should be a mouse and an elephant. They should love each other. The mouse is so small and inadequate, and the elephant is so big. Why don't they love each other? What is it? We haven't quite completed the concept. Because there are situations where something very small and inadequate can be next to something very mighty and great, and there isn't love. And there shouldn't be love. So there is another factor apart from that which we've mentioned. There is another concept that has to be thrown in addition to everything that we've mentioned this far. But that in Yitzhak Hashem we'll do next week. The principles that we need to understand for this week is that the fulfillment of a need is nothing to be ashamed of. And to talk out one's needs are nothing to be ashamed of. For one to let another person know the extent to which one is dependent on them, nothing to be ashamed of. It's an expression of love. To say to somebody else, I need you, is a compliment. It's not an expression of my own inadequacy. It is, in a sense. But it's an expression of humility, not inadequacy. It's an expression of understanding, of defining, I am not complete on my own. There are aspects of me that are only fulfilled through you. And that's something that a beloved needs to know. Whether it's a friend, a partner in one's work, a colleague, a wife, a child, a parent. It's important to know that. That there's a need which is being fulfilled. It doesn't matter. It's not the end of the world. And the tests are that the fulfillment of that need can never be ultimately fulfilled. Then it's a spiritual love. If one finds that when you fulfill the need, you can say, Yeshikah, thank you very much. Now I'm satisfied. You can go. That wasn't love. That wasn't love. After the loving, there has to be as much need for one another as there was before. If after the loving the need disappears, that was no loving, that was no ahava. And the second, that the very action of doing something for the beloved or with the beloved, quite irrespective of its end result, although the end result is also important, but quite irrespective of that, to be able to find pleasure in the doing and the action itself, just as we find pleasure in involving ourselves in a creative act, even if we know we're never going to get to the end. Start working on something that's going to take you years or you might never get to the end. Doesn't matter. It's so creative, the action itself is so creative that we enjoy the action and we do it as an end in itself as well as a means to an end. So when one is relating to a beloved, one is doing it as an end to itself as well as an end in itself as well as being as a means to an end. And so it should be in one's Torah and mitzvahs as well. That the act of learning is something one must find pleasure in. If Chaim Volozhiner says in Nefesh HaChaim, that part of lishmo, part of learning for its own sake, is learning because it's geshmak. If you come to a person and you say, why do you learn? And he answers, because I need to learn. I'm dead without it. One's tendency would be to say, that's why you learn. I thought you learned because the Ribbono Shel Olam told you to learn. It's not necessary that that's such a low level. On the contrary, he's being very honest and he's coming out with perhaps an even higher level. It's true, the Ribbono Shel Olam told me as well, and therefore I would learn even if I didn't enjoy it. That's true. I don't learn because I enjoy it. I would learn even if I don't enjoy it. But the fact is, what's really motivating me is it's a geshmak, I enjoy it. It's like the person who says, I would eat even if I wasn't hungry. If I knew I was starving, I was suffering, I would eat because one has to eat. But if you ask me now why I'm eating now, I'm eating because I'm hungry. Nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with learning because I'm enjoying it and doing mitzvahs because I'm enjoying it. And in fact, if one's going to develop an ahavas Hashem, one has to develop the capacity to enjoy the things we do. Once we've decided that they need to be done and that it's right to do them, we must develop the ability to find pleasure and happiness in that which we do, and to find a fulfillment of an inner need, something that's being motivated from within us. We're doing it because we need to do it, not only because it has been imposed upon us from above. It has been imposed on us from above, and therefore we would do it irrespective. But there has to be also something within us that is making us do it and that is driving us to do it. And with that one, it develops an ahava, and one starts finding one's Yiddishkeit becoming emotional. One starts finding that it's no longer a list of actions that it has heart to it, it has warmth to it, it has pleasure to it, it's good, and it becomes a lot richer. It becomes something important. In Mir Tashim, we'll take these ideas further. Those of you who can should look at the Medrash and should understand it. And as I've always said, with these shiurim as well as with any other shiurim, we said it in fact last week too, as important as it is to listen and to understand them, it's even more important to start doing them. Even this Motzei Shabbos shiur, perhaps this shiur more than any other shiur, is lamaisa. It has practical ramifications as much as anything else, and one needs to try and start putting it into practice. One needs to try and exercising it, and to find you'll experience a great deal of difficulty with it when one starts putting it into practice, and to work on it and to develop it and to begin to grow in that area of action.